We're going to call this meeting to order, members. We have a quorum. Good afternoon, members. We have on the agenda today a number of things, so let's get started. I'm passing around a few sweets for you so we can all stay awake. Representative Emmer, would you approve the minutes?
I'll move the minutes for approval.
I'm sorry.
I would love to have that.
Thank you. Thank you. Approval of the minutes. Okay. All right. Those in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. We have some announcements this afternoon. We have, as of February 8th, the following bills are hereby referred to the Mental Health Division. House File 737, House File 793, and House File 794. Representative Thiessen, please. Representative Thiessen, would you please state your name for the tape? And
yes, Paul Thiessen, state representative, I guess. And I would move, Madam Chair, House File 1 be recommended for passage and re-referred to the Government Operations, Elections, and Technology Committee.
So moved.
Members, we heard this bill a couple of weeks ago. And as everybody knows, there's a delete all that I think has been circulated to everybody for a few days. And I thought I would just walk through the changes, not go over the stuff that we talked about before, just walk through some of the major changes, and then we can move on from there. I think there's a few testifiers today. I guess what I have to do is actually move the delete all, Madam Chair, if I can move the DE1 amendment, which is the delete all.
The delete all, DE1.
Yes. And that's just to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
So moved.
We need to
vote on it.
Yes,
members. All in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Aye. Nays? And the amendment has been adopted.
Thank you. And maybe if I could at this time do one more author's amendment to the delete all, which is the A6 amendment, just to kind of get it in the shape I'd like to have it for discussion.
The A6 amendment. So moved.
And members, what this does is it addresses Section 9, Subdivision 4, which is the passive renewal provision. We're going to make that non-passive, I guess. We're going to go back to the technique we use for all the other programs. So DHS sends out a renewal form, and you have to actually act and send something back. It works better under kind of the program that we're setting up here. So I'd ask for your support on that.
All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? So moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. The main changes in the bill, in the delete all, there's a lot of changes that are simply kind of technical changes related to Medicaid conformity to make seeking the waiver easier and administration of the program easier. Beyond that, just a couple things I'd like to highlight. On page 2, in section 6 on eligibility, subdivision C, so at line 2.18, We've changed the language there as we discussed at our last meeting, the delete outs has different language, which continues to call for a program to be put in place to move towards coverage of all children over 300% of poverty, but it doesn't set any of the parameters of that program and leads that to the task force that's set up later in the bill. In section 10, which is formerly section 9 of the bill, which relates to how we are going to deliver services, several changes have been made. First of all, the language has been changed to allow more options at the discretion of the Department of Human Services, I suppose, for how they're going to contract and deliver the services under this program. And with respect to that, I'd also ask you to look at, you don't have to turn to it now, but in section 17, there's a provision that requires the department to come back to us to talk about what they've decided before it kind of goes into action. So that's the first part of that. The second thing is further down on page 6, on lines 6.5. And what this does is it's an attempt at some payment reform to use our payment system to encourage more of the kind of care that I think we want. So this involves a withhold in the payments we make to managed care programs, where we would set standards, and if those standards are satisfied, then they would get the money. So basically, we hold back 5% of the money of our capitated rate, and if certain standards related to lead screening, well child services, immunizations, etc., are satisfied, then they will get that money later. And we actually have something similar to this in rule at least already, but this is to focus it in the children's area to make sure we get the kind of performance that we really want. Section 11 relates to payment rates, and we've added two things in there. Subdivision 2 is an increase in provider rates of 5% for preventive services and 3% for other services. And that's true whether it's a fee-for-service program or a managed care program, because those fees, it would be an increased capitation rate, but it would have to be passed through under this provision to the providers. And just a little background on that, we actually have some actuarial analysis that was conducted on this program, which the conclusion reached by the actuary in looking at commercial versus government programs concluded that a 2.8% increase, in fact, would hold providers harmless if all the children at 300% moved out of commercial programs and into the public programs. That is not going to happen under this bill, first of all. But the two factors that it looked at, we talked about one of them before, is that commercial insurance pays a higher rate. And so by moving kids to public programs, you're actually reimbursing providers at a lower rate. And so that's a concern, and we need to address, and this is an attempt to get at that, and I think there'll probably be some more discussion about that today. But in addition, the other thing that the actuary looked at in making their analysis is that once we get kids insured, we'll have a lot less uncompensated care, which kind of cuts the other direction. And so that is what the actuary who did this analysis came up with. So we're actually kind of exceeding that amount in this bill. I think we'll probably have some more discussion about that issue with questions later on, but that's what that's happening. In addition, in Subdivision 3, starting at line 7.19, again in an attempt to try to move towards purchasing quality or higher quality care or more cost-effective care, we put in a direct performance rate bonus that's actually between the state and the provider. It wouldn't go through a managed care program. And if particular providers or groups of providers meet performance standards with regard to coordination of care and preventative care, they would get an additional bonus payment under this provision. And the only other thing I'd like to highlight that's new is in Section 16, we actually have some explicit language about outreach and how we would provide some grants to accomplish that. So, Madam Chair, that's kind of the highlights of the new provision.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And the bill is in the order, then, that you want to proceed?
Yes.
Okay. And we have some testifiers. At this time, I'd like to call up Deborah Holgren. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Christine Almeida, and I represent Portico Health Net. I have with me today Deborah Holmgren, who is the president and CEO, if that's the title, of Portico Health Net, who is here to speak in support of the bill and answer any questions you might have, and also to talk a little bit about Portico itself.
Thank you. Go ahead. Please state your name for the record, too.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Deborah Holmgren. Portico is a nonprofit organization whose sole purpose is to help low-income working families in Minnesota get health care coverage. It's not easy to do, but since 1995, we've assisted over 11,000 people onto public health care programs or Portico's access program, working in partnership with counties, school districts, churches, health care providers, and other community organizations. Last year alone, through our outreach efforts, Portico helped over 700 metro area residents successfully enroll in Minnesota Care, medical assistance, or general assistance medical care, thanks to contributions from our 9 partner hospitals. During 2006, Portico also provided access to a comprehensive range of medical services to another 1,100 uninsured individuals who did not qualify for any government programs. About one-third to one-half of these individuals were children age 18 and under. So first, I've told you the stories that represent our successes. On the other hand, only 20% of the total number of people that Portico screened in 2006 even appeared to be eligible for a government program. So for every 10 people we screened for eligibility, only one eventually became enrolled in a government program. These uninsured adults and children were not eligible because their family income was slightly too high, their employer offered insurance subsidized at 50% or more, but the premiums were too high for family to afford, or the Minnesota Care premium was too high for the family to afford. A major problem is that there are still too many families and children in Minnesota who need insurance and can't afford it. Every week, Portico communicates with an average of 40 to 50 new families who are not currently eligible for anything affordable in terms of insurance coverage. The second problem is that it's difficult to get people enrolled in government programs even when they appear to be eligible. We currently employ 9 people at Portico whose jobs are to identify people in the community without insurance who might be eligible for a government program and help them work through the process of applying. Last year, we initiated the application process for 2,100 individuals. Only 735 of those individuals were eventually approved for MA, GAMC, or Minnesota Care. That means for that every one person that got on after we started the application process, 2 didn't. Sometimes it's a matter of being on the borderline for eligibility, and income may have been just a little too high. More often, the problem is related to a process that is too often carried out in such a way as to discourage enrollment rather than facilitate it. It's not unusual, for example, for a family that applies for medical assistance with us helping in November to not become enrolled in the program until 6 months later due to the county's backload of applications. And when application review is delayed, families are sometimes asked to provide duplicate supporting documentation or asked to go back several months, for example, to come up with the required paycheck stub from an employer for whom they may no longer even work. Portico supports the Children's Health Security Act because it addresses the first problem that too many children in Minnesota are not eligible for health care coverage and consequently are not accessing needed services. We support the Children's Health Security Act because it also addresses the second problem of barriers to enrollment by reducing the complexity of the enrollment process and providing for outreach assistance with enrollment. Many ideas sound good on paper, but our 12 years of experience tell us that if we want to see Minnesota's children get enrolled in health care coverage, the program needs to be straightforward and understandable. We can't make the situation for uninsured, low-income families even more complicated than it already is. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the members? Representative Abler?
Just a comment about Portico. They're a great outfit. They reach into a very needy area and someday we'll talk more about that. And Madam Chair, I think there's some students in the audience. I think they're just homeschool day. Yeah. Nice they can come and join us and watch the legislative process. So I want to welcome them, and I'm sure you can too.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here. And thank you, Representative Abler, and thank you both for testifying.
Thank you.
We have our next testifier, Tara Ryan. Come down, please. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Tara Ryan. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm here to advocate for children, one of the children being my own. I have a four-year-old daughter who does not have health insurance and has not had health insurance for 2 years. I've been fortunate enough to always have a decent enough job where I have health insurance, and when I was pregnant, my daughter, my health insurance didn't cover the full birth for my daughter, so I was I received medical assistance to cover the rest of the birth, and then at the time there was a program where she was grandfathered in to receive medical assistance for 2 years. When the 2 years was up, I was aware that the 2 years would run out, but her father was court-ordered to pay for health insurance, so I just assumed that because he wasn't being responsible and helping with that situation, that the county would continue to give her medical assistance and that he would just, it would just come back on him to repay the county. And that was not the case. My daughter has asthma, and the first time I went to pick up her medication for a one-month supply, it was almost $400, which is something that I cannot afford to pay for. So for the last 2 years, my daughter's been going to St. Mary's Health Clinic, which is, just for people that don't know, is a health clinic within the Twin Cities that helps families who cannot afford insurance, and it's all volunteer doctors and nurses that are set up in churches or other buildings. And I'm very thankful for the services that they have given my daughter, but there are drawbacks to it, which is you can't, if you're having an issue with your child, you can't get them in until the day of the week that they normally see the clinic, which her day is Tuesday. So if Thursday she's sick or Friday she's sick, she can't get in until Tuesday to see somebody. Also, along with her asthma, she is not seeing a doctor consistently or the same person, and so we've been treating her with a different medication that they prescribed because they also could not afford to give me that medication that was $400 a month, which was used through the nebulizer machine. So she now uses a preventative medication through an inhaler, but she has not seen a specialist or a pediatrician so that I know whether or not she even needs to continue taking this medication. I have applied for Minnesota Care and been denied. I've also applied with Portico Health Net and been denied because of my income. I work for St. Paul Public Schools. I have a bachelor's degree in human services, and I'm currently attending St. Thomas working towards my teaching license and my master's degree. I feel like I'm doing everything that I can as a single mom, but I need help. I cannot afford to pay for the insurance. The district obviously offers health insurance, and the amount for the health insurance for my daughter is $360 a month, which is something as a single mom I cannot afford to pay for. And because my employer offers health insurance, I was denied with Minnesota Care because my employer pays, when the two of us are looked at together, it's considered single plus one dependent. And because my health insurance is paid for, it looks as though more than half of hers is also paid for, so I was denied Minnesota Care. Because I work with children and I have a child of my own, I see every day children that need to go to the doctor or to the hospital. I've had kids at work fall and break their arm. If that would happen to my daughter, having to bring her to an emergency room or even think about having a bill like that, I would never be able to pay for it. Simple things that a lot of people probably take for granted is a few months ago, pink eye was going around her daycare. She had pink eye. It was the weekend. It was a Saturday. I go into a pharmacy, try to get medication, and of course they can't give me medication because I don't have a prescription, but I don't have a doctor that I can call and say, I know my child has pink eye, can you give me a prescription? Instead, I'm going through other families that have insurance and using their children's medication because I cannot get something for my daughter, and I don't want to take her to an emergency room or an urgent care because I can't afford to pay that bill. She's going to be entering the four-year program this coming school year with St. Paul Public Schools, and she still needs immunizations, and I don't know how she's I don't know how I'm going to get those. But obviously she's going to need them in order to go to school. And that is something that St. Mary's Health Clinic does not offer, as far as my understanding is. So I'm just here as a working mom, a single mom, someone that is on the right track, that is doing what I need to do, just to say that there are hardworking people out there that need help and that cannot afford to pay for health insurance for their children.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Ryan. Any questions from the members? No. Thank you so much. Phil Griffin is our next testifier. Would you come down, Mr. Griffin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I'm representing both UCARE and Preferred One, but I'm here today speaking on behalf of the 8 nonprofit health plans who make up the Minnesota Council of Health Plans and provide health care coverage to over 4 million lives in Minnesota and the surrounding states. We would like to express our support today for the efforts of Representative Thiessen to expand coverage to available to uninsured children in Minnesota. You, as members of the legislature, should be proud of these efforts and the efforts of previous legislatures, which have consistently made our state one of the leaders in making health care coverage available. Yet, with 93% coverage, 7% of our citizens still need coverage. House File 1 is a laudable effort to provide coverage to children who make up a large portion of that remaining group of uninsured. While we strongly support the intent of the author to expand coverage, we're concerned with some of the provisions of the bill. By way of example, Section 10, Subdivision 2 requires that health plans improve the quality of care that are being given to enrollees by changing the behavior of providers. At the same time, the bill gives a portion of the payment that have gone to plans in the past to the Department of Human Services to distribute based on quality improvement. Minnesota's health plans are committed to working with our providers to improve quality of care. Our work in developing initiatives like the Minnesota Community Measurement Project and the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement are proof of these efforts. These are nationally recognized award-winning programs. These cooperative efforts between plans and providers have worked to make measurable improvements in care based upon guidelines developed in conjunction with the providers and based upon the best evidence available to the community. Giving DHS the incentive payments would take away from plans a valuable tool for controlling costs and improving quality. Another concern we have in the bill is an inconsistency between Section 6, Subdivision 2 of the bill, which states that this program is mandatory, and Section 6, Subdivision 4, which states that the newly created program is voluntary. Madam Chair and members of the committee, these are two examples of the concerns that we have with the bill before you. We look forward to working with the authors as this legislation moves forward to attaining the goals for improving coverage for Minnesota. If there are questions, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'd be happy to take them at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. And do we have any questions, members, for our testifier? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I had one other comment. I know that in the previous committee and Representative Huntley's hearing, there was a question as to where all the health plans were. We were all over in the Senate at the Commerce Committee hearing on health plans, and we apologize for not being here, but we are concerned about what is going on at St. Mary's Duluth and those improvement programs, some of which are the exact same guidelines being used by the health plans. And we are trying to work with the providers in those. When you see what's going on in terms of payment to those plans, those providers in the improvements that they're making in treating heart conditions, it's dramatic improvement, and they're losing money. It just doesn't make sense. And those are the kinds of things that we're trying to avoid. Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the opportunity, and we look forward to working with you and with Representative Thiessen as this legislation moves forward.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sorry. Representative Norton.
Thank you for the testifier. The very last reference you made, you mentioned voluntary and mandatory, that there was a conflict, and I'm not finding it where you referenced it. So could you repeat what you said, perhaps because we have a delete all, it's in a different place?
Madam Chair, I don't know, and Representative Norton, I haven't got the bill in front of me. As I read the bill, it looks to me like in Section 6, Subdivision 2, the bill states that the program is mandatory. In Section 6, Subdivision 4, it states that the newly created program is voluntary, if I'm reading it correctly.
I'll read through and see if I can find it. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, the program is voluntary, so I will have to talk about that. I don't see the reference in here either that you're referring to, but we can talk
correct
about that going
right
forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Broad has a question for the testifier.
Actually, it's kind of related. Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I read it that way as well, and so we might want to just talk about this a little bit. On lines 2.19, it says that children and families shall be included, and so I do read it that way as well, and maybe we just talk about that a little bit.
Yes, sure, and Madam Chair and Representative Broad, it says that they shall be included in the program, and then as part of the program, it says enrollment is voluntary. So, if you read the whole thing together, I think you gotta temper what says it shall be included with the fact that under the program, which you're going to be included in, enrollment is voluntary. I mean, if we can work on the language, but the way I would read it is that it's voluntary.
Madam Chair, members, and I think Representative Thiessen agrees with us. Our worry, and as he talked about his actuarial analysis, the goal is not to pull people that are out of private coverage into this program, which would increase the cost dramatically. We're concerned about deterioration of the private market as well, and that's the reason we raised the concern.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen? No?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we have one more testifier, Dr. Katcha. Growell, come to... Come down, please. Please state your name for the...
My name is Katia Rowell, K-A-T-J-A, Rowell, R-O-W-E-L-L. I don't think I was on the agenda. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to address this committee today. I'm a family doctor. I'm currently on maternity leave. As a family doctor, I have had the privilege of being a doctor, a friendly shoulder, and an advisor from birth to death. I practice in a range of settings from indigent resident clinic, VA clinic, rural group practice to college health. I did not go into medicine with an interest in politics of healthcare, but the frustration of practicing in our broken system has compelled me to learn about and to work towards a better system. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Universal Healthcare Coalition and the organizations it represents that are dedicated to achieving a Medicare for All style system. We wholeheartedly endorse the intent of HF1 to extend coverage to all children and to eliminate premiums and cost-sharing requirements. Dr. Jack Garland spoke with you last month on behalf of MUHCC and shared the evidence and data behind our support for purchasing medical services directly from the clinics and hospitals that treat patients. We support the new language as reviewed today by Representative Thiessen that includes direct purchasing option in Section 10. Rather than repeat the evidence Dr. Garland presented indicating that including the HMO middleman in the new children's program will raise costs and reduce quality, I'd like to share some of my personal experiences as a provider. A major part of my daily work was spent muddling through mazes of bureaucracy, dozens of HMOs that I dealt with basically daily basis, each with different forms, formularies for drugs, tiered copays, paperwork, pre-approvals, waiting on hold, rebutting utility reviews, fighting to get a test pre-approved, while at times getting further and further behind. Is it any wonder that doctors are often running late? Indeed, our office had a small army of staff that dealt solely with billing the various insurers. One evening provided a particularly clear contrast between Medicare versus HMO-run Medicare. So this is getting to that fee-for-service versus through the HMO issue. On call, two of our patients presented with chest pain to a small rural emergency room. The patients were stabilized, and I determined both needed transfer to a larger hospital for further testing and more intensive monitoring. Bob and Betty, as I'll call them, were both in their 60s. Bob had plain old government-financed Medicare. I called my preferred cardiology group, called the ambulance, patted Bob on the shoulder, and sent him off to excellent care with doctors he and I trusted as well as respected in a private medical center. Betty had an HMO-run Medicare. I spent the next 30 minutes on the phone, copying cards, calling companies, calling the in-network hospital to see if they had a bed. When they did not, calling a second-tier hospital, knowing I'd have to fill in papers explaining why there was no room at the HMO's preferred hospital, paging cardiologists I didn't know, waiting and waiting, finally sending the patient to a hospital that had a lesser-regarded cardiology department. The government-financed Medicare patient actually received faster, easier, more efficient care with greater choice and control. Thankfully, both did well, but to me, this was a wake-up call. Government can be more efficient, and a market economy with its need for overhead or profit is not always the solution. Later, I learned that the HMO-managed Medicare patients cost taxpayers a minimum of 11% more, some suggest higher, and actually have worse mortality rates than patients in government-financed Medicare alone. Bottom line is direct purchasing saves money in Medicare, saves it in other states' Medicaid programs, and in the private sector. And we have the supporting data again, but it was presented by Dr. Jack Garland. We're happy to see this committee dating a bill to extend coverage to so many more of Minnesota's most vulnerable. First and foremost, we urge you to avoid requiring the participating children to be managed by various private middleman insurance companies. This was actually changed today, so I apologize for repeating some of that. It is important that the commissioner report precisely how his service delivery plan will avoid those pitfalls to produce the best plan for children. Secondly, we support that DHS require health plans to provide missing data that will allow independent evaluations of their claims of improved quality and better access, which I believe was addressed today in Section 13. In conclusion, we're confident that given an even playing field, the direct purchasing publicly funded model of healthcare delivery will be shown to promote better statewide health outcomes at lower cost than multiple private health plan companies can. And perhaps more importantly, it will allow maximum freedom for parents and doctors to choose and provide the best care for their children and patients. Thank you for your time, and we look forward to working with you as this bill moves forward.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions from our members? Okay. Representative Stumper.
Madam Chair, witness, in your opinion, can fee-for-service or direct purchasing plans be designed to deliver good systems of preventative care? That's a big concern.
I'm not sure what you mean by systems of preventative care. In my Medicare patients that I took care of that were in the fee-for-service system, I gave them exactly the same care that I gave the Medicare patients in the HMO system. I don't know that I saw much value added by some of the disease management plans that some of the HMOs are coming out with. I don't think that really changed how I practiced medicine. I don't think it added. My patients would get cards sent to them saying, you're late for your pap smear, and this was disease management, and they'd come to me and say, well, I had a hysterectomy, so I don't need one. What is this? I don't know that the HMO disease management added to what we were providing the fee-for-service patients, okay. Personally.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Adler, did you?
Yes, I have questions about the bill to the office.
To the bill.
I just have some questions, and I realize this will be discussed in other committees as well. And I appreciate your effort on the rates, and you know that we have some discussions about that. And the voluntary thing, I did have some questions about that, and I'm glad it's going to be voluntary and not mandatory, although it's, I think in phase two you do move into a broader category, and it appears that your hope is to draw more people in for this than just the uninsured. Is that correct in phase two?
I think that is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Madam.
And Madam Chair, I've got a couple questions and I have a comment. Just to caution you, should this become law, and who knows what happens this session with anything, but I appreciate, as you know, the effort that you're putting forth to do this important work, and you know I share in the effort. We differ in the method, but our goal is the same. But just to caution you about the, as you do the, even as you made the renewable eligibility discussion now mandatory, but have to do something, we were told already that the department cannot do the eligibility reviews of 120-some thousand people in Minnesota care now. If you remember the hearing you had this, I think before the election, they came and they said they couldn't find enough staff. We bought staff. We gave them money for staff, and they couldn't find them, just to caution you. So it's a bureaucracy that can't, it's, so just to caution you as you, I know you want this to succeed. The quality stuff, I think, is you're on the right track. And I just wanted to offer a couple of thoughts. I don't have any amendments to offer today, and I just wanted to, I gave you all a packet. And I know some of you are new to the committee, and there's some of these things you haven't been through, and as this goes forward, I urge all of us, as we this is House File 1. I have a clue it might pass today. I don't know. I just have a hint about that in the back of my mind. But as this goes on and as the debate heightens in March and April, and as we work on a product to actually pass out of here, there's some things I hope you understand. And I'll just give me a couple minutes, and I'll just go through this packet that you have in front of you. The page one is from the Department of Health. And the reason I was hammering on 7.4% is that's who's uninsured. And I just want to caution members that in the last 4 years, at least the 4 years represented here from 2001 to 2004, that Raleigh Group plans, which is public, whether it be union plans, private insurers, who's ever in a group of any kind, lost 8%. We, over that time, for all what you heard, the people in the public programs actually increased by 18%. And at the same time, the uninsured increased by 30%. And my caution to all of us is to try to buy our way out of this by thinking that the employers are a part of the problem is an impossible situation. And the more employers who quit offering coverage because we've made it more difficult or we disincent them from covering, we just invite a fiscal note that we cannot bear. And that's my caution to you from these numbers. And if you're in my division last year, I heard this discussion more than once, but I wanted you to be aware of that, and we can discuss that some more later. But this is numbers from the Department of Health and the Ferro and Graph. The second page just talks about, so you understand who already we do have in these public programs. And the 25% that are in public programs from page one, I think would include Medicare. But who we cover now in the state programs is about 13% of our people. And I'm not arguing that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just pointing out there's a lot of them there already. And these are people that we subsidize to a limited or a very great extent. And I just tried to summarize, with all regards to Randy Chung, I plagiarized your papers here. But there are these, if you read nothing else about those programs, these three short two-page summaries will help you understand what you're doing, because actually this bill, if it were passed, would create these kind of programs for the kids that you're trying to insure. And if you like that, then good. But there's some bad things about those programs, which you may already know. And then I'm not going to read this next article to you, but there's a fascinating, at least in my life, like I said, another life, but 10 pages of from the Department of Health, again, what would it cost to cover the uninsured? And I think as we weigh into this, I hope you recognize I'm urging you all to policy, to let's do it so we do it something that we're proud of, and at the end we're glad we did it. And that's 10 pages, which you'll have to read on your own, but on page 5 of that study, toward the bottom, it talks about what it costs $1.6 billion to insure the uninsured, 383,000 some people. And then a fascinating factor, which I think Representative Bunn might get a kick out of, on page, the next page, in the middle paragraph, it says to do it through the private sector, giving them insurance that costs $1.4 billion. And I don't understand that, but that's kind of the key to how we got our money for our deal. And I don't understand that, and there's reasons, and there's all kinds of asterisks. But as we dissect this, I think we need to understand the asterisks, because we're the ones who are making decisions. And then the final thing, in this report, one final element, which Representative Thiessen, Representative Huntley, and I, and everybody else, Representative Loeffler, all care about, is that this is already, money is being spent already in the system. And it's being spent by, in that first bullet point, $250 million per year has been on uncompensated care, and that number is whatever that number means, but we'd argue about that real dollars or lost. But that's up to $250 million is being spent by hospitals and clinics where they're not getting the money. And if you, Hennepin County serves people, there is universal coverage now. It's called the emergency room. And we've discussed this at length. And they go to Hennepin County, which I'm happy with. I live in Anoka County, but we have our own. That's just a joke part. But they spend a ton of money, and that money is put under the property taxpayers to the county hospital. Anoka County has Mercy, and they just take it out of their own private sources. But that's not the way to fund health care out of the property tax on vulnerable seniors. So there is a real problem, and I'm here with you. And then finally, the last three pages are testimony you've already heard. But I want to remind you, there's some numbers here from Dr. Dinell, and then he sent an email about this very bill. Not that he's not wanting to serve, but he wants to be able to serve. And with all respect to the actuary, I cannot believe that a 3% and 5% increase will get them to where they have to get. I remind members that the that the rates that are paid in medical assistance, which is what this is based upon, it's actually the lowest rates paid in Minnesota, are for 1989 at the 50th percentile. In 1999, they got a 3% raise, and they've been there since, except for the various groups who need raises. And we hear all the time from groups who need raises. We gave the psychiatrist last year a 23.7% raise. The department came here yesterday or whenever it was with raises for psychologists and people doing counseling. And because the rates are so lousy, to get them up to cost, they'll actually find them to do the work. And so I want to urge members as we move ahead today to please heed these voices and to listen to the debate and to weigh in our own better ways. And we may have to create a model that doesn't exist. And we may have to find a way to take the best parts of the TSM bill and the best parts of Humphrey's work and the best parts of FREMBA's work and all of us, maybe the Abler bill, a little bit of that, and find a way to craft something that works, that's sustainable, that will actually promote access to all the people who need it. So that's my thoughts.
Thank you very much, Representative Abler, for the information. I appreciate your passion and the work you've done on this, in this area. Thank you. Representative Thiessen, to the bill.
I'm open to more questions. Just okay. A couple of points, and I appreciate, and Jim and I, or Representative Hickler and I have talked a lot about this, and we'll continue to do so. And one thing that I think we fall into when we talk about health care is we divide out the dollars we spend, and Representative Abler kind of alluded to this, we divide out the dollars that we spend in public programs and the dollars we spend in private programs, and I don't think that's the right way to look at it. We ought to look at the overall health care costs of the system. Because that's really, we're all paying for it one way or another, as Representative Abler and others have alluded to. I would note just a couple of things. The actuary, again, that has been hired to do this work, estimates that parents or families are going to save about $283 million a year in premiums and out-of-pocket costs under this legislation. Employers are going to save about $182 million per year in premiums. And then the uncompensated care issue, which Representative Abler raised. I mean, we are spending about $70 million in Minnesota on uncompensated care for these folks that are kids under 300% of poverty. That's money that's now going to be insured money. So that's money coming back into the, I mean, it's savings to the system in another sense. Finally, I guess two other points I'd make on that. By having one application process here, one reimbursement process, we are going to see some administrative savings that we wouldn't otherwise see, where the providers would otherwise have to figure out whether a particular issue is covered, a particular treatment is covered or not. And so I think, you know, if we look at the system holistically, I think that we come to some different judgments about where we end up on this issue than if we kind of segment it. And I think our discussion is poorer when we kind of break this down into segments. We need to do that, but we also need to take the holistic look at the system. So that would be my...
Thank you. And Representative Gottwald has a question.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Representative Thiessen, you and I talked a little bit about this yesterday, and I appreciate Representative Abler providing some information about it today on who are the uninsured. And we've been kind of circling around this for a while. A lot of the premise behind this kind of legislation is the idea that we're going to get people who are uninsured insured, and we all want to accomplish that. But it kind of ignores the reality of why people are uninsured and why they're not covered. And when you start breaking down some of the numbers in here about the short-term uninsured, the people who are in transition being up to 60% of those people, and 40% being more long-term uninsured, and then you start asking why are they uninsured? Are they uninsured because they're eligible but people haven't enrolled them? Are they uninsured because they've chosen not to enroll in whatever we're offering them? I think we need a little more thoughtful discussion about why people are not being covered. And it's not because we're not doing right by them in a lot of cases. It is because either they have chosen not to access it, people who are in charge of their lives have chosen not to utilize what they're already covered for, or they're in transition. You know, these numbers are trotted out as big numbers, and we should be concerned about them, but we need to be honest, I think, about the real reason behind these uninsured statistics. And so I'm glad this information is out here, but again, as we have this discussion going forward, I hope we're willing to look at that realistically and talk about why people are not accessing coverage, especially coverage we already have available to them.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, I think that's a fair comment. I would note that for children, it's actually about 50-50. It's not the numbers that you pointed out. But even someone is a child that's uninsured for 9 months, you know, at certain ages in particular, but kind of the whole time, that's problematic. And the other thing that that means is once they're uninsured, they lose their primary care doctor, and so they have to arguably reestablish a relationship with another primary care doctor. That's bad for continuity of care, and it's bad, which leads to different health outcomes. It actually adds more cost to the system, too, because the new doctor is going to have to learn more information. So I think that it's a very fair comment, and we do have to look at that. But I don't think just because a child is uninsured for a shorter period of time rather than longer, I think there's still costs related to that.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, in order that we don't have any misunderstanding, because we want this to be voluntary, even though we may disagree on how we define uninsured and how people fall within where they're at, this is what's before us. And I'd like to propose an amendment to you that, based on what you said earlier, I'm assuming that you join in supporting it, line 2.19 on page 2 under section 6, subdivision 2C. I would propose to change the word shall to the word may. So it would read, poverty guidelines may be included as opposed to shall. I think that's more consistent with what you've represented here today, that this is a voluntary program. I understand the way you're reading it, but as you probably know better than I, the rules of statutory construction take the words as they're written, and shall has a completely different meaning than may. So if it's a voluntary program, that's what we intend it to be after July 1st of 2010, if indeed it becomes law, then I think the amendment that I'm proposing is consistent with your intent. So that would be the proposed amendment.
Representative Thiessen.
And I think there's going to be an amendment coming that deals with this section. I respectively disagree with the reading of how this works. What this is saying is that there is going to be a program in place as of July 1st, 2010. Under that program, enrollment is voluntary, and the language is very clear about that. The amendment you're proposing, and we may have discussion more about this issue when we get to the amendment, would say it's going to be up to some discretion of the commissioner or of this legislature of whether we're even going to have a program for over 300% of poverty. So I'd rather have that discussion in the context of the amendment, which actually I think gets more at the issue. I'm happy to talk more about that concern, but I don't think that the change you're proposing actually, I think it has larger consequences than you're suggesting are getting picked up.
Madam Chair?
Representative Emmer.
Then out of respect for the author, I'll withdraw.
And Representative Emmer, let me suggest this. Perhaps you could say, federal poverty guidelines shall be eligible to be included.
At this point, Madam Chair, I think I prefer, based on my respect for the author and his words, I'll withdraw my oral amendment and wait for a discussion on the amendment as he suggests so I can maybe understand more fully what he's doing.
Thank you, Representative Emmer, Representative
Thiessen. And maybe, Madam Chair, we should go to the amendments and then we can have the final discussion once we see if things are changed.
Okay. And to the amendment, the A11 amendment, Representative Laufer, I believe that's your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A11 amendment. And members, what this does right now is currently the bill provides that we would cover students who are full-time enrolled post-secondary education students. And it's come to my attention, and that's current law, that we would cover full-time enrolled students under dependent programs. And it's come to my attention that there's some problems with that in that the health plans or health companies have problems with verification of keeping track of from quarter to quarter, semester to semester, that the person still is eligible. And students are running into problems in that they may take an internship, which, as we all know, is in today's job market a really big key thing to getting a job after graduation, which typically offers less than full-time credit. Sometimes it's not even done for credit. And so they have a semester or quarter in which they are no longer considered full-time because they're not carrying a full credit load as determined by that institution. And you have students who may take a semester or two off to work and save up money so their debt load isn't quite as high. And so this would provide that we would say that any child who is a dependent up to age 25 would be eligible for this coverage.
Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Emmer.
To the amendment, and I suppose this is for Mr. Chen, 25 seems to be, it sounds to me like that's the 6 or 7 year plan for post-secondary education. Could you explain, Representative Loeffler's represented that the law is that under all our programs we now cover as dependent children up to the age of 25. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. Representative Emmer, I believe that what Representative Loeffler might be referring to is there some, private sector insurance requirements that use a similar definition of dependent student and would require coverage.
Representative Emmer.
So, Mr. Chen, when it comes to our public programs that we offer right now, how are those worded?
Mr. Chen.
Sure, Representative Emmer, I know that the Minnesota CARE program until a few years back did use a similar definition of dependent sibling. However, I guess recall at this point whether that similar concept is applied under medical assistance. I'd have to check on that.
Okay, thank you. And by the way, I'm sorry I'm mispronouncing your name. I should know by now. Apologize.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. And Mr. Griffin,
Member
yes.
Committee, Phil Griffin again, representing Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We do support the Council of Health Plans expanding this age limit. It is in our own self-interest, and we admit that covering more lives will bring in more premium. But we also think that there's a vulnerability to the population going in and out of higher education. It's very difficult sometimes when students are full-time and then aren't full-time. I have a good friend who has an example of a child who dropped a couple of credits this semester, will be full-time this summer but isn't now in the spring, and it's going off. So we think the legislature ought to be looking at this. There is separate legislation moving forward that will expand that age to 25, and maybe that's dealt with in that separate bill. But we do want the committee to be aware that we are in support of this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Griffin. And we have Representative Liebling. You have a question? I had you down.
I'm going to pass.
All right. Representative Norton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking for clarification from the author. So am I understanding this that we have changed this from a student education-related clause to just we're covering all children up to 25, whether they're a student or not a student?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, no, this is only for dependents. So you have to be able to be declared a full-time, fully dependent upon your parents to qualify for this, which typically is a student situation, but people do go in and out, like I say, with the internship thing, with, maybe they take a job that they think is relevant work experience that's helping them achieve credibility. And so this is no, it still says that you have to be claimed as a dependent for federal income tax purposes.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Let me follow up. So what you are doing is taking out any reference to student. So this, if I'm understanding, that's what I was looking at. It doesn't require you to part-time, full-time, anytime. If you're living at home and you're dependent, or even, I think dependency is up to 6 months or something, if you're claimed on your parents' income tax, no matter what you're doing, you're covered.
Representative Loeffler.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Norton, that's correct. It just takes out the verification that they are at the current time a full-time post-secondary student.
Thank you. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, I appreciate your amendment. I'm actually speaking in support of it for the reasons that you stated. We have so many of our young people who aren't able to take full-time class loads because they're having to work, not just to support themselves or helping out with their families. And as we all know, higher tuition keeps going up. And so if you're only taking two classes and are not a full-time student, you lose your coverage as a student. And so any opportunity that we can be able, and so many of our kids are at community colleges, and so we don't have at like the U, where you can go to Boynton. And so any opportunity that we can make sure that we're keeping our young people insured, even if they don't understand the benefits of that, I think is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Walker. And Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another area that's really pretty serious is when they get mono in college and then lose their health insurance. That's a big piece in that whole piece.
Thank you. Any other discussion on the A11 amendment? If not, all those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Now we have the A7 amendment. Representative Emmer, is this your amendment, A7? Yes, Representative Emmer, to your amendment, please.
I do not have it. Oh, there it is. The A7 amendment, if you will turn to page 2. I'm sorry. Lines 18 through 23, and essentially it takes out the reference to the statute 256N.05, which is...
It's new language in the bill. Yes. It eliminates subdivision 6C from the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Houston. Okay. So are we voting on this amendment? Any discussion?
Oh.
Discussion to the A7 amendment?
It's not my amendment. I would prefer that this amendment is not adopted, but why don't we have it?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I think we did already have some of this discussion, and I think this is what we were talking about earlier. This is just a little bit more dramatic than the oral amendment that I posed earlier.
Just a little bit. And members, just to explain again what Subdivision 6C does, is it says that as of 2010, July 1st of 2010, we want to have in place as a legislature some pathway to making sure that every child in Minnesota is covered. That doesn't have to be under the language. The program that's being established in this, the terms and conditions that are being established in this legislation. There's a task force set up in this bill, as folks know, to look at what's the best way to make sure that we can get people over 300% of poverty covered. I guess what this provision does really is it sets a deadline on us to say, let's get it done by 2010. And so that's really what's going on here.
Madam Chair, and I would just add to that, the disagreement that the author and I have at the informational hearing that we had, I asked a couple of questions about the language specifically in Section 6C. When I asked the author, I mean, why do we even couch it in terms of shall be, whatever, essentially what this language does is say for the first couple of years we're going to have everybody whose gross household income equals 2 or less than 300% be eligible, and then all of a sudden we open it up to everybody. We have a disagreement about that, and I think my amendment addresses that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Thiessen,
and I did change the language since before, and that's what that second sentence says. It says the requirements for eligibility, you know, who would be eligible, the form of the benefits, and other terms and conditions of the program are going to be determined by the legislature. It's going to come back to us after the task force takes place. So I did try to address the concerns you raised, and I think at that last hearing I said that was never my intent, that we kind of agreed on that intent to begin with. Well, we completely agreed, but that's my response, I guess.
Well,
and all I would ask for support of this amendment is we have the task force. I don't think anybody has established how in the world we're going to pay for this. We've heard how it's going to save premiums for employers and going to save premiums for the people that pay them, for the citizens, but in fact, those premiums still have to be paid somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think we've debated enough. I'm sure that I'll get plenty of support, and I look forward to the vote. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. And to the amendment, then, all those in favor of the A7 amendment?
Yes.
And all those opposed?
No.
To the next amendment, the A10 amendment. I'm sorry. The amendment is not adopted. All right. Now on to the A10 amendment, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill is currently before you envisions the State Department of Human Services taking on all administrative responsibilities, including eligibility determination, providing information and assistance to individuals in selecting a health plan, and providing ombudsman services to help them when they have issues about whether or not covered services were provided or have issues about whether or not their benefits are being interpreted correctly by whatever plan they sign up to. And traditionally, this has been a shared responsibility between the state and local counties. And counties typically do the majority of eligibility determinations. Under Minnesota Care, originally the state was going to do exclusively all the enrollment and eligibility determinations, and then when they found out that the workload was greater than they were able to manage, they invited counties in to increasingly take over more of that responsibility. And as Representative Abler pointed out earlier, it continues to be a challenge for the state agency to keep up with the workload of that. On the issue of the ombudsperson issue, for all the counties that are currently in managed care arrangements under the prepaid medical assistance program, they have received some limited state funding to hire managed care advocates, they're called typically, who help enrollees with issues related to accessing benefits, appealing denials of service, that sort of thing. In Hennepin County, we were one of the first pilot programs. We've had those people on staff for over 20 years, and they've developed a fair amount of expertise, which is difficult, particularly in the metro counties, where you may have as many as 5 different plans being offered with different ways of handling different appeals and other sorts of issues. And so what this amendment would do was just retain the option for counties to continue to provide those services with staff that have developed that expertise, or for the state to do it, and with the dollars just flowing to whoever steps up with that responsibility. If a county decides we're going to let the state assume this responsibility for this program, it encourages the state to, in its hiring, consider those people who have a lot of experience and expertise playing this exact same role with the public contracts in their hiring, but it doesn't require them to hire them. It just says they ought to do some recruitment because this is a lot of expertise that's been developed in people who've proven an ability to work with a very diverse, low-income population and have developed some trust there. And so the intent of this amendment is simply to give the current system an opportunity to be continued if counties decide that they want to continue to provide that service. There may be some cost efficiencies, quite honestly, in the counties that are currently in the prepaid medical assistance program because those same advocates would handle appeals and issues related to this small program as it starts out, the Children's Insurance Program, which would probably run into the same issues that they have on medical assistance and Minnesota Care and general assistance medical care under the PMAP program. And so the concept is just to let the dollars flow where the responsibility goes and to, as we go into the finance committee, continue to look at the options of where does it make sense. But since this program is starting out smaller, with the hope that a broader plan will arise over the interim, and we'll be back discussing having a lot of people, and this seems like a good way to handle that initial implementation.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Representative Loeffler, as you're offering this this amendment, as I'm reading it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know I heard you say it doesn't say you're guaranteed employment, and I'm right. I'm glad to hear that. It says they shall be given hiring consideration by the commissioner. Well, if they apply for the job, wouldn't they be given consideration anyway? I'm not sure what this is accomplishing.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, my concept is that we have people who have a lot of experience, but they may not know when the state is hiring for a person to do this. And I mean, so that there would have been affirmative outreach to people who have developed expertise in that, and you know that they would consider them then in filling positions that would become available.
Madam Vice Chair, if I may, the problem is this language doesn't do what you're saying it should do. There's nothing in here that suggests that the commissioner needs to reach out to and recruit these people. It simply says that they will be given hiring consideration. In other words, if you want to accomplish what you want to do, I'm suggesting the language doesn't do that.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, I intend to talk to the Department of Employee Relations to really work out exactly how this would best be affected. But first, I thought the whole concept should come forward, and then we can see how within the state's hiring system this might work out best. And so you understand my intent is to make sure that that opportunity is made available. I'm just not sure about the exact hiring processes and would want to explore that further before when it gets dealt with finally in the finance division.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, can you help me understand something a little bit better on lines 1.16? It says that state and federal funding to support these services shall be the same. Can you help me understand that a little bit better?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Broad. But this is that I assume that in the fiscal note we'll have a cost estimate of what eligibility determination is. You know, you need, if you're to cover the whole state, you need 10 FTEs or one FTE per every 10,000 enrollees or whatever it is. And that when we set aside that money, that if the staff is hired by the state, you know, the money goes that direction. If half of it is counties, half is the state, that the money would just flow to where the responsibility is. So that it isn't a situation where if counties step up, it's an unfunded responsibility. Nobody would step up. Even though that might be a better situation both for the state in terms of maybe potentially a lower cost than if the state were to set up and start a new program in particular counties.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, excuse me, and Representative Loeffler. So I must be reading it a little bit differently, I think. I'm wondering about when you say they have to be the same, what if the federal dollars fluctuate? Does that mean that the state dollars fluctuate right along with the federal dollars? And maybe I'm reading it too exclusive, the sentence itself. But it would appear to me that if you say that the funding has to be the same, the fluctuations then would have to be the same. Am I reading it wrong? Or
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Brown, my concept is, okay, and is that if we appropriate, let's say, $30,000 of administrative funds for a portion of this. And that's probably way too, I mean, I know that's way too low, but let's just take that figure. And it turns out that about a third of the responsibility is going to counties that have stepped up, and the rest is staying with the state. You would assume that $20,000 would be available at the state level and $10,000 would be available to the counties. It's just to make sure that you don't end up with an unfunded situation for either side. So when we, because this is a county option and the counties will decide whether they want to continue this responsibility, then you really just want the dollars to follow the responsibility in the same proportion. And so that if the federal match rate changes, you'll get less federal dollars whether you're a state employee implementing this or you're a county employee implementing this.
Representative Brad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I'm not necessarily opposed to that idea, you know, in terms of the mandate. I understand that I do have similar concerns, I guess, to Representative Gottwald in terms of what that language actually says versus what we want it to say. My thought would be, I know it's conceptual, but my thought would be it would be better, I think, to conceptually work on it separate from the amendment. Wondering if you just let those two pieces go, we can move it along and then maybe work on some of the language. I don't think the concept is matching the language, which is what my concern is, too.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Brown, I think actually the working out of the finances is more of a purview of, quite honestly, the finance division. And the employee provisions, having served on government operations last time around, that is their purview, and that's the next committee that this is going to. So I would like to have the concepts worked on in the appropriate committees as this bill moves forward. And if we don't put the ideas forward here, and I don't serve on government operations, I don't think it, the concept that we want them to look at will come forward in the same way. So I think I'd like the committee recommendation, and then I will work with the author and members of government operations in the state to make sure that the wording is appropriate.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Vice Chair, then perhaps I respectfully suggest that if we want to clean up the language in the respective committees, that perhaps the amendment ought to happen in the respective committees as well, if it's not really a policy issue.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Gottwald, actually I think the policy decision of whether or not we want to continue the state-local partnership, which has been historically part of the delivery of human services and where counties currently have staff fulfilling these functions, should be a component of this program, is, I think, a policy choice for us to make. Other committees can work on the details of implementation, but I think the policy choice before us is to say, do we want this to start out from day one as a new state-administered program with new state staff hired for what will be a smaller program, or do we want to use the efficiencies of currently using county staff in counties where that capability currently exists?
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, and to the members, I think some good concerns are raised about some of the language and how this gets drafted. And I will work with both of you to work, and with Representative Loeffler, but with to work out those as this moves forward if the amendment goes on.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. To the amendment, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, on consideration, does that mean the department has to interview these people?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, actually, I understand our current hiring process right now, they are given a list of people who meet eligibility, background and experience standards established by the state, and then the department has the chance to go through that list and decide who they would interview. But this would mean that they would, if they met the experience and training requirements, actually get on the list for consideration.
Representative Hamilton.
So then that's yes, they would have to interview those people?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I'm not sure. I think it could be interpreted that they'd get an opportunity to get on the list for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And it is time to vote on the A-10 amendment. All those in favor of the A-10 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I would like to move reconsideration because our staff person, Mr. Chun, has pointed out a drafting number that needs to change. So if I could bring back the amendment.
I believe so.
Sorry.
I think you move to reconsider the amendment?
Is that a draft here we can take care of in GovOps?
Okay.
Can we do that in GovOps?
That's fine. Well,
Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, maybe you can just indicate what the drafting area might be, and then we can make a decision from that point.
Representative
Madam Chair and Representative Broad, it would just be to correct the cross-references on lines 1.8, 1.9. Instead of 256N.12, it should be 256N.17, just to refer to the right section.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
we don't object to that moving forward the way it is. So.
Thank you.
Actually, I mean, can't we just amend the bill as it's amended?
Yep.
Why don't we just do that? I would move that we amend that to put 1.7 in those two places.
All right, and do we need to vote on that? We need to. All those in favor of that amendment to the amendment, say so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed?
No.
And it is adopted. Okay, we're on to the next amendment. This is the I have a A12-1 amendment. Where's the page? We need.
Mm-hmm.
And members, do we all have the 812-1 amendment? The amendment author, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this follows along in sort of the same vein of trying to, in some respects, keep our system the way it is currently, and in some ways to make sure that all counties have the same option. The bill as it's currently drafted opens up some new opportunities for service delivery options. And what we have had in the past traditionally is when the prepaid managed care program has expanded out to additional parts of the state, and I think we still have a number of areas of the state that still don't have that option. We have in statute a provision that says county board shall be consulted to advise the commissioner as that rollout comes to that part of the state, and that as those plan contracts are rebid, as public health goals are proposed, that the county board is an advisory partner in this development of a service system within their area. And so the last, so B kind of keeps that historical role of the counties as advisors to DHS and implementing programs. It applies it to this program just as it applies to medical assistance and general assistance medical care and Minnesota care as those changes are implemented. The first section A actually says that all 87 counties shall have the same opportunity to explore new service models, and that the current system right now is that particularly in the metro county, the county-by-county consideration has not been an option. The PMAP is bid out on a seven-county metro area. The RFP was done on a seven-county metro area. They were not allowed to submit public health goal suggestions on a county-by-county basis. And Ramsey County had spent a lot of its own property tax dollars and a lot of staff time exploring a county-based purchasing option for rent to implement as an option within their county, and the current federal Medicaid waivers and laws have not permitted that to happen in a metro county. And DHS did work with our congressional delegation and others to try and seek that authority and was rebuffed, but as we all know, the Congress has changed and leadership has changed, and there may be an opportunity to have a federal government that's more willing to give metro counties some flexibility. It would still have to go through all the other safeguards and processes. This would just simply say that as they're seeking federal waivers to implement this law, that they would try and once again seek that flexibility and allow for a consideration of county-specific differences.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler and I talked about this briefly yesterday. I understand the direction that this amendment is heading. This is a bigger change that goes beyond the Children's Health Security Act,
mm-hmm.
Raises a lot of issues related to county-based purchasing, among other things that I think merit maybe some more broader discussion. So I would just ask that, first of all, we'll hear this. If you put this into a bill, I promise that we'll hear this, but I would like, if we can, if the amendment could be withdrawn, that would be helpful.
Representative Loeffler?
Madam Chair, Mr. Thiessen, and Representative Thiessen, we didn't have a chance to talk about this, and I had actually offered to do it either way, and we weren't sure about whether there was committee time to sort of look at those other options. I would say that on Section 6, the consultation, or the section, the D, which allows for advice and consultation with the counties is certainly not a change in policy, but we can deal with that at a later point too as well if you'd like. So I'd be glad to withdraw at this point. But I just wanted, if we're going to direct ourselves to go to the federal government and seek waivers, it makes sense to continue to look at what other waivers do we need in service delivery.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler withdraws the A12-1 amendment. And to the next amendment, the A9 amendment. Is that Representative Broad?
Well, Madam Chair, this actually is Representative Emmer's amendment, so I'll offer it up for him. It essentially is just requiring a citizenship requirement to be eligible for the program.
To the amendment, Representative Thiessen.
I would oppose the amendment.
And Representative Howe.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I know that in here it says you have to be a U.S. citizen. There are many legal immigrants as well, and so I it would also exclude them. I don't know whether you want to or not. So.
To the amendment.
Madam Chair, I haven't seen this amendment up until this point. Why don't we at this point just hold on to that? I'll withdraw this amendment and we'll hold it so I can get the better information so that we can have a reasonable discussion about what I think is an important issue.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Broad withdraws the A9 amendment. On to the A8 amendment.
And Madam Chair, I think this may have been, I think we may have taken care of this already.
All right. We're... We are to the bill. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for your consideration of this legislation. It gets at a lot of issues we talk about a lot in this committee, about quality and access to health care. And I think that what this bill does, at least for children, it does set us on the path in an achievable path, an achievable goal of getting insurance to all children, and I think that is a goal that we all share. The policy considerations, I think, that are before this committee are four, really. One, the policy goal here is to remove obstacles to coverage, and it does that in several ways that we've talked about in the past. It eliminates the complexity from the system. A second policy goal, I think, is that it recognizes the changing nature of employment in our society and the changing nature of employer-based coverage that we are seeing, and it basically says, as a policy matter, children's access to health care shouldn't be determined by whether their parents have work or the type of job or employer that their parent has. The third thing is that it does take steps in the direction of paying for the kind of quality health care that we want in terms of preventative care, immunizations, and well-child visits, the things that will prevent greater costs into the future. And the last thing is, I think there will be, with this legislation, savings to the system overall in administrative costs, in terms of cost-effective care, in terms of getting children to the doctor before their care gets very expensive. So on all those fronts, I think that this is a wise policy for us to adopt going forward, and I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen, and thank you for bringing this important piece of legislation to this body. And with that, we will vote on the... Pardon me. Representative Otremba had a question. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen. We've talked a little bit about this. It's on page 5, and it's 518 through 523.
Yes.
Well, I'm not going to do an amendment, but I'm just, for some clarification... It talks about ease of access to quality medical care for enrollees, efficiency, cost, and breadth of choice. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means within 60 miles or 30 miles, 17 miles. I really want a clarification of just how far these kids have to go for their health care.
Representative Thiessen.
And Representative Trump, I think that's a very legitimate question to raise. These are factors, general factors to be considered. And I'm happy to talk more about if we can figure out what that radius, is that the right word, would be. I'd be happy to work with you as we go forward on that, because I do think that that's, especially in greater Minnesota, a serious concern, as you know better than I do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And members, to the bill. You will be able to vote on this very important bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is passed. We'll go on to government ops.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen and members. We are adjourned.